From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at a concert in Nashville, Tennessee. The great Elvis Presley had just delivered a performance that brought the house down, so to speak. He was at the peak of his musical career, smiling, laughing, capturing the attention of everyone in his audience. But backstage, it was a different Elvis. According to various reports, Elvis would tell his crew that he wanted them to look out for attractive young girls, underage girls that he assumed were virgins. He referred to them as cherries. And he got into trouble when he brought a 14-year-old girl named Jackie backstage. He said he would teach her to, quote, kiss in a grown-up way. Jackie's mom stepped in, but this was not the first time this had happened, and some reports indicate Elvis put money in the girl's books as a kind of compensation. Matthew Walther wrote a piece for The Week titled "The Sexual Predators Everyone Still Worships." It's a quick catalog of the many stars who committed crimes or behaved poorly before the age of Me Too. Mick Jagger, Chuck Berry, Jimmy Page, Steven Tyler, David Bowie, Marvin Gaye, Miles Davis, Elvis Presley, Charlie Parker, just for starters. Walther writes, quote, "Most of this has been in plain sight for decades, not lamented or agonized over, but simply ignored, or worse yet, consumed indifferently as mere gossip and forgotten. Finally, we've decided to start caring about it. This is an unambiguously welcome development. But beyond pursuing credible accusations and delivering the stingy justice of the courts, what else is incumbent upon us? How much do we want to commit to? If Weinstein's name is to be removed from the credits of television shows in the production of which he played even a small part, what are we to do with the mountain of records, CDs, posters, books, memorabilia, commemorating rockers? What about the so-called Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? How many great records are worth the assault of a single woman or child? Are we affirming or materially contributing to their crimes when we watch films or read books or listen to music made by abusers? Is one confirmed incident enough for us to quit them?" End quote. Well, the answer is we don't know. No one has an easy answer. It's subjective. Will you watch Louis C.K. videos again this year, next year, in five? Never? Our guests this hour are going to discuss what we do with the art of artists who have behaved badly. And unfortunately, that's a long list of artists. The guy who really sparked this conversation is the founder of Writers and Books, who's got a story to share in a moment. It's Joe Flaherty. Welcome back to the program. Nice to have you here,
thank
Joe.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Also with us is Jonathan Nithketha. Sorry, Jonathan.
That's quite all right.
A lot of THs.
Yes.
Senior Assistant Director of Student Success and Outreach in the Multicultural Center for Academic Success at RIT. Welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Patty Lewis, a local actor, director, and teaching artist. Patty, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And on the line with us is Bob Thompson, director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Bob, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
Just sort of a quick temperature taking before we get into Joe's specific story that I can't wait to talk about here. Just bizarre and wild. But just sort of taking the temperature, you know, Jonathan, before the hour began, you were saying no one is going to have exactly the same answer as the next, right? I mean, this is really subjective stuff here.
It really is. And I think it comes down to our individual values, our collective values as a local community, as an artistic community, but then also as a global one or a national one. And all too often we follow where the tide is taking us and we don't think to right the ship ourselves. And so that's why I'm excited we have a chance to talk today about it. Because there is no answer in the next 55 minutes. It's not going to happen, but the conversation as to what is okay and what we feel okay with is something I think we need to delve into.
Okay. Have you sworn off anything, by the way? Are there certain artists now that you're not going to pick that book up, you're not going to watch that movie, you're not going to play that clip?
It's really difficult. I stopped having heroes a long time ago because heroes are simply humans and humans have flaws. So heroes have flaws. And so I stopped trying to have people be role models beyond what I see. Growing up as African-American in the 80s and 90s, it was Bill Cosby. And in the most recent years, obviously, Me Too, in terms of actual reckoning for the behavior that many people kind of looked past in the past, Bill Cosby's at the forefront of that. But I grew up loving the Huxtable family and the information and the entertainment that we received. And it's tough because I haven't yet broken out those DVDs to show my younger sons because I want to show them all those cool things that happened and the great stories that I remember. But the behavior was something that is just not It's not good. And I don't want my sons to learn that that behavior is okay. So I have to come with come to terms with it. And it's very difficult. So I'm kind of in hiatus mode until I can figure out the right words and the right understanding that I can share with my sons. So they understand that while this, there are some good things that the show has given, looking at the behavior of the artist is where we really need to look at.
Hmm. Patty, have you sworn off anything yet?
I haven't been able to watch a Woody Allen film in years, just because, there's obviously all artists put themselves into their art, but some people are more auteurs than others. Mm-hmm. And I think that, when someone says, okay, this is my work, this is really kind of me, and then they do things that make you feel really uncomfortable, and then they put a reflection of those things in their work. That's what I find really hard. I'm sure there are plenty of things that I've loved and watched made by people who may have done awful things I don't know about. And then when you find out those things, it's interesting how your filter changes. Mm. Because all art is in context. It's in context of the artist and of their audience.
Let's turn to Bob and Joe, and let me read a few comments from Twitter here, because I asked our followers here of the program online, do you draw the line? Do you stop consuming art from artists who are sort of on this list that is this growing list? Doug says, no, then I'd have to stop listening to Miles Davis. Trish says, that's it. You never consume them again when they have stepped out in this way. You don't support them. William says, only when reprehensible behavior is part of the actual art. Otherwise, we are making assumptions about everybody else, including ourselves. Deborah says, is there a way to enjoy the art without benefiting the artist? For instance, watch a Kevin Spacey movie, but he no longer receives royalties from it. Some of them have important or enjoyable work, but who wants to support an abuser? It's a good question. It's an interesting way of looking at it, Deborah. If you're buying a used book, it's not the same as buying a brand new copy of a book from someone who might have or is confirmed to have been an abuser. So Bob Thompson, someone who works in popular culture and understanding popular culture, this is quite a moment. Are you shutting the television off at times, Bob?
Well, I have not quit consuming the work of a person because of one of these stories, but I've certainly changed the way I look at them. And this goes back to, remember when Michael Richards, Kramer on Seinfeld, got caught on tape in this incredibly nasty racist tirade at a comedy club? I still can't watch Seinfeld in the same way. Same goes for Woody Allen. Same goes for a lot of these. And in some cases, like Louis C.K., now that we've heard all these stories and you go back and watch what I think were some really brilliant shows, you see so much of what that story was already happening. But at the same time, I'm about in a couple of weeks to start a summer class for master's students on the history of television. And we do 3 weeks on the emergence of African Americans on TV and behind the scenes and all the rest of it. And you cannot erase Cosby from that equation. He did some extraordinarily important things. I Spy was the first time we had a African-American male as a co-star in a dramatic show who was educated and dignified and attractive and all of the rest. That was a really important moment, as was Fat Albert, as was the Cosby Show. So, when you teach this stuff now, you've got to almost go through a five-minute apology and contextualization, but not only can we not make that stuff go away, I don't think we would want to make what Cosby did for television go away.
Okay. So there's a lot there. And Joe Flaherty, has this story that when I heard the story, I thought, this can't even be real. Philip Roth just passes and you get all of this, I don't want to say hagiography, but this respect for the work that he has produced for many years. Your story goes back to what, 91, 93? What happened?
1993. It was an era in which you could call up, you could get the telephone number of just about any writer in America, and talk to them. And so I...
How, by the way?
Well, there was a thing that was called the Poets and Writers Directory.
You had the directory.
I had the directory.
We didn't have that.
I would go in and call up people, say, can you come up to Rochester for a reading? And I called up Philip Roth's number, And a woman answered, and she had a British accent. And I was thinking, wow, this is really classy. You know, he's got a British secretary, you know, answering his calls. And she said, well, who may I ask is calling, and why are you calling? And I told her, you know, I'm Joe Flaherty from Writers and Books in Rochester, and I'd love to see if it's possible for Philip to come up and, you know, read from his work. And she said, well, he's not here right now. When he writes, he goes to our house in Connecticut. And then she said, our house in Connecticut. And I was like, oh, this is not a secretary, you know.
It's his wife.
It's his wife. She said, so let me, you know, take your name and number, and I'll give the information to him. But I don't know why you would like to invite him. He's a very despicable human being. And I was like, ooh, you know, what have I gotten myself into here?
She wasn't kidding.
No, she wasn't kidding. You know, and she said it in a very, you know, calm British, you know,
straightforward,
reserve,
yeah.
You know. I don't know why you would want to invite him. He's a completely despicable human being. And I said, oh, you know, so she said, I will give him the message. And I thought, I'm never going to hear from Philip Roth. You know, I mean, this, I don't know what I got into here. So the next day, there's a telephone call, and it's from Philip Roth. And he says, hello, you know, may I speak to Joe Flaherty? I said, this is he. He said, well, this is Philip Roth. I said, oh, thank you for returning my call. He said, I understand you spoke to my wife. And I said, yes. She said, and what did she say about me? And I said, well, you know, running through in my mind, you know, I said, well, she said that when you're writing, you go to the house in Connecticut, and that's why you weren't there. And he goes, yes. And what else did she say about me? And I said, that was really about it, you know?
So left out the whole despicable part.
Yeah, right. I was not going to get into that. And so we arranged for him to come up. I mean, he was going to come to Rochester for a reading. And the day of his reading, he was fogged in at LaGuardia and just could never get out. And we said, talked to him. He called several times. There was no cell phones at that point. But and he said, well, let's, you know, we'll talk in a few days and rearrange. And, you know, it never really
never
happened.
Came to be.
Never came to be. And I found out later that it was at a time just before they split up, and it was really a kind of a horrible situation. And both of them wrote tell-all books within the next year.
About each other.
About each other, yes. But the interesting thing, getting back to this topic, was that after I announced that he was coming, I got lots of phone calls saying, I don't understand why you would invite Philip Roth to come up. He treats Jewish women and Jewish mothers horribly. Why would you invite him? And I would say, well, you have to separate the writer from his characters. And I mean, that was just sort of my answer to them. So, you know, if you do not like somebody's writing, that doesn't mean that, you know, that's particularly his point of view on everything. You know, otherwise, how would you have writers be able to create villains? I mean, if there's going to be a villain and there's going to be a hero, I mean, somebody has to write that villain. And if you think, well, that author created that villain and that villain is a horrible person, I don't want to, you know, hear or meet that person. So that was really sort of, I mean, there was a number of times throughout my career I had to do that sort of, say, separate the author from their characters.
So let me ask all of the panel then, and I'm going to push Joe a little bit on this and we'll get everybody's take, because this is one of the central questions here is, do you separate the art from the artist? Or is it sort of tied inextricably? You know, Joe, if I'm an author, you know, I'm writing fiction, and I am writing plots that contain violence against women, that kind of maybe carry all of the stereotypically awful things. If I'm writing racist characters, if I'm just using my fiction as a vehicle for really bad or ugly ideas, don't I bear some responsibility for that? Isn't there some?
Well, I think it again goes back to context. If the author is creating that character so that you can, as a reader, get into the mind of somebody who's
okay,
a serial killer,
sure,
or a racist, to better understand, you know, what kind of thinking, what kind of person thinks that, I don't think they're glorifying that. They're just saying, okay, here's a character that I've created.
Sure.
And, you know, there are serial killers out in the world, and I've created one so that you might read this and have a better understanding, in an immediate way of what that kind of person is.
Okay,
like.
That's fair enough. And now let me ask the question a different way. Do you separate the art from the artist in that in their personal lives, they do things that are either criminal, horrible, abusive, but their art, separate, it's a comedian, it's a writer, it's an actor, it's anybody. It's not related to that personal life. Do we separate it? Patty, do we separate those things?
I think that once you have that knowledge, it is bound to color your perception. And I think there's also a gradation. I mean, if someone is clearly a criminal, let's say Harvey Weinstein, still alleged, but, you know, let's say that those things
are... Yeah, well, tell his lawyers to come
okay.
after us. He's,
yes,
he's a criminal.
Yes, okay. So,
allegedly.
You know, that to me is an extreme, okay? I saw a play many, many years ago, one of the earlier plays that Tracy Letts wrote, and it was a play called Killer Joe. And after I saw this play, I thought it was one of the most misanthropic plays I'd ever seen. And I was determined that I would never see another Tracy Letts play. So when August Osage County came along and it got the Pulitzer and it won the Tony and people were saying how wonderful it was, I resisted. And then when I read it and when I finally saw it, it was a different piece of work. It was as though it was from a different person. And perhaps it was. Maybe this artist had changed and grown in that period. I would have been sorry to have let that original impression color my opinion of everything that came after for him. But having said that, there are some places that I can't walk back from. As I mentioned before, you know, Woody Allen, you know, Roseanne, Bill Cosby, I agree. I mean,
But you just mentioned three, all of whom are unrepentant. Turn themselves into victims. And that's very different.
It is different.
Than I'm trying to imagine, I mean, Louis C.K.'s apology. I mean, I'm trying to think of there's probably a long list who've acknowledged some degree of wrongdoing or contrition. You just mentioned three who have done the opposite. And I understand sort of the animus you would feel to someone who not only abuses but refuses to be accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. I think that if people aren't capable of change and capable of growth, then that's a pretty sorry thing. And it may take decades. It may take years.
Yeah.
But... you know, in the meantime, the work that was made during that period is always going to be colored by that, I think.
Mm. So let me get Jonathan and Bob here. And here, by the way, Jonathan, is CJ emailing us about the Huxtables. Mm-hmm. He says, as your guest said, we are all human and flawed. I think our heroes are fictional. The Huxtables are still role models. The actor is not the character. We need to focus on teaching our children to see art as aspirational and teach them to critically evaluate news, stories, and heroic actions. Perhaps by seeing the flaws, we can all strive to correct our own. It's from CJ.
Well put, CJ. And I will retort with one of the tweets I just dug up from my account after Charlie Rose departed.
CBS we haven't even gotten a journalist yet. Yeah, right.
And my six-year-old asked, what happened to the older guy, Charlie? And I said he did things that were disrespectful and made others feel uncomfortable. And my son said, but he was great at news. And I said, but you've got to be great when the cameras are off, too. Right. And so that was a very clear, there was an opportunity to talk about it because there's language floating around my house when the news is on that I have to teach a 6 or 7 and 5 year old kids about. And I think that is the point. And I think one of the pieces that we always have to remember when we're thinking about this is that there's power in being offended. And there's being able to say, I'm offended and speak it out, there's power. And we need to acknowledge that power because it's surfacing and people are getting a chance to breathe and be acknowledged in a way that in the past it hasn't been. And so I think for us as consumers, as community members, we have to ask ourselves, why are we offended? Does it have to do with a trauma that we experienced? Does it have to do with something that has been taught to us or that we've never really had a chance to come to terms with for ourselves? And going back to my acting life, I did this one scene back in college where in our stage fighting, and we had this one scene, and there was domestic abuse in it. And my friend and I, who did the show, she's a woman and I'm a male, we did this. And afterwards, she had members of her sorority there, and she was trying to introduce me to a couple of them. And one in particular, particular was so, she was not going to look me in the eye or talk to me or acknowledge me. And I was thinking, man, this is tough. She's white, I'm black, and maybe this is about this. But is there a level of trauma that was there? And so me as the actor, I had to understand that her perception is colored by her individual reality. And yes, the whole scope of this is that we're letting individual people breathe and share their experiences. That's got to be the case. But we have to feel comfortable at least engaging, or as artists, understanding that, you know what, I messed up, or maybe what I'm choosing to open up or write about is something that's going to cause someone pain. That's a risk that I'm taking with my art. And artists have always been risk takers. It's when they start to work against another individual that it becomes problematic and difficult.
Hmm. Bob Thompson, what's the temperature of students on college campuses about this? What are you hearing from students who might say, well, you can't use this in the lesson, you can't use that?
Well, they're very attuned. Their consciousnesses have been raised, and you do have to preface an awful lot of stuff that one discusses in class. But, you know, this is a luxury we've only got for relatively contemporary art, stuff that's maybe a few centuries old. I've got to think that in that shelf of the great books of the Western world, there are all kinds of things we continue to assign to high school students, to college students, that were done by people who did reprehensible things we just don't know about. Think how we revere Shakespeare. We know practically nothing about Shakespeare, and what we little we know about the relationship of his wife maybe is actually not very positive. So there is a sense, I think, that so much of this stuff we watch and love, we may have other reasons to not if we kept applying this equation. I struggle with this constantly, and just recently news came out that really gave me an interesting perspective on it. You all heard the story about Einstein's travel diaries from back in the 20s and 30s. This to me really brings this to the, you know, right to the core.
Bob, let me just jump in and just make sure our audience is up to speed there. The travel diary from Einstein indicated that he had some derogatory remarks about people of Asian descent. I'm trying to remember if it was Chinese.
Lot of derogatory about the Chinese.
About the Chinese, their children, in a lot of derogatory ways that surprised a lot of people who otherwise heard what Einstein had said about sort of equality and opportunity for years. So, but this is pretty well confirmed. So anyway, go ahead.
Right. Okay. So, and it's true. He said this way back, and he later became a great advocate of civil rights and all that kind of thing. But let's just take those comments. There are some people who will read that Einstein thing, and the response would be like, let's not watch Cosby or let's not watch a Harvey Weinstein film. What would the response then be for Einstein? Let's not. What? I mean, E equals MC squared, whether Einstein was a serial killer or whether he was a saint. And that, I think, lets us kind of focus that in the end, I suppose, the assessment of the art is really what matters. We don't know how well behaved the people are who make our exquisite dinner at fine restaurants or put our car together. I mean, in the end, I think we have to look at the texts themselves. And then the rest of it, as to whether we want to support those by buying them or whatever, that really, I think, is a matter of one's own individual values. But some of these creations may be done by people who did bad things that we don't know about. They may be done by people who did bad things that we do know about. But some of them still have value in spite of that reprehensible that it may have come out of.
Yeah, I guess the pushback I'd have there, Bob, is I think the art can have value, but the world doesn't need it. And maybe I've just gone through a little loss in family recently. I've been thinking about really heavy stuff like death. And I'm, you know, when you experience a loss and yet you're driving down the road and you still see it's a beautiful sunny day and the sky's blue and you're thinking, how can the world still be turning without this that I just lost? And then you think, well, the world doesn't require us. This world does not require me or my life. It's not required. Just as art can be valuable, but it's not required. The world does not. The world will keep spinning without the art of people if they've done bad things.
That you're right. If all of the Woody Allen movies suddenly disappeared,
the world would go on.
The world would continue. However, if you make that argument, that ultimately says that the world itself could continue without art, then I suppose it for quite a while.
I don't think the world should continue without art.
I don't think it should either. further, and I think if we make the Woody Allen argument, we then have to make sure that we apply that across the board whenever we find out about the artist itself. And I think that we could find ourselves rejecting some things that we need and that are very, very good. I mean, look at some of the stories that circulated about Dr. King. Do you want his work, therefore, to be eliminated? I mean, this really leads us down a complicated road.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, William Golding, author of Lord of the Flies, Joe, admitted that he had once tried to rape a 15-year-old schoolgirl when he was 18. Do we take Lord of the Flies off all the shelves and off all the rating lists? I mean, I don't know.
I think that to the conversation about what is required, the world will keep spinning and going on, yes, but art requires our truth. And I think that all artists tap into a level of truth. If it's our fears, I always think about Guillermo del Toro and all the monsters he must have seen in his life to create these fantastic monsters we watch on television and film. You know, that it requires our truth. And I think that kind of going to the college world at RIT, we had Dan Harmon scheduled to come in and be our featured comedian in winter. But that's right around the time that Megan Gans, his former a writer on Community, alleged sexual harassment. And even though he apologized, and Megan Gans herself accepted that apology, and I encourage you all to take a look. It was on the 11th of January on Twitter. It's a fantastic feed that she put together about how satisfied she was with that. Still, we are making decisions that say we're going to silence this person because they had access to a platform, but they did something that took that power away from someone else. We need to take it away from them. I feel personally that there was a moment there that hopefully our students are looking for, to understand how to engage in making it better. Because we can say, yes, Me Too, time's up, we can do that. At the same time, the pendulum has to swing back to the individual who was transgressed against, the victim in that case. And if this victim is saying that she felt that was an acceptable apology, it's a masterclass on how to apologize, then who are we? Who am I to say that, no, that's not okay? There's another conversation. I would have liked him to have maybe a podcast or speak to students about what he did, prepare students for how to behave or what to expect in the world when they go there. There's another level that our artistry has to transcend beyond just entertaining us with Community and Rick and Morty. It has to inform us.
Yeah, I, and I'm thinking, by the way, if you're on the phone, we're going to get to your phone calls in just a second. There's a lot of different people want to weigh in. John, Steve, we'll take your calls in a moment. I can't get my head to unwrap around one idea, though, that is really tough and important, I think. Just observing most of what Me Too is about, most of it, not all of it, most of it is about what women have experienced and how they haven't been believed. Ronan Farrow, who wrote one of the two pieces on Harvey Weinstein that broke the dam and has written so much great journalism, and of course, part of the Farrow family, but Ronan recently said the best thing we can do for women is not just, he's not saying don't believe them, he's not saying believe them, he's saying take them seriously and investigate as thoroughly as you can, because that's what didn't used to happen. They used to not have anything investigated. They used to not be taken seriously. So Ronan Farrow is saying, don't forget about believe or don't believe women. Take them seriously and investigate. Try to ascertain the truth, and when you do find the truth, find the consequences. And I'm looking at what women have had to deal with, and I just can't help but feel like if there aren't consequences now, in other words, if we go back to just consuming the art and there's not a penalty, do we go back to a world in which women have to continue to deal with it? I don't know.
Well, I feel so privileged to be still teaching young women right now and having the conversations that we have together, because it was true that at a certain point you did just have to, you know, sit there and listen to some things and know that if you said anything, that it really wouldn't make much of a difference, that it really wouldn't make an impact. And I think that there is a really, really, really long history of women being silenced, not just on this topic, but on a lot of other things where they could have made contributions, where they could have made huge differences. And we're finding out in some of them that they did make huge differences with absolutely no recognition. You know, when we think about the people, the women who worked in the space program and without recognition. And yes, it feels so much better. And I can see it in my young women students. I can see how there are things that they don't have to accept. Mm-hmm. And for someone who's a little older than that, it's so wonderful. It's so wonderful to be here now and to be having those conversations, too. I mean, and I think that's one of the things that we have to remember, that if we do just say, oh, no, you can't watch that, you can't watch that, that some of these conversations go away, because there are things that I see sometimes that I don't really think that much about. And then somebody will say, oh, you know, that makes me feel this. And I'll say, oh, I never thought of that. Mm. Because you're coming from, you know, a different perspective than I am. And then I start to say, oh, yeah, of course. And it's like this. And for me, and those conversations, that's how things are going to change. Hmm.
Joe, you want to add to that?
Well, I think Bob made a lot of good points in that, you know, we can go back, you know, centuries from where we are right now, and we have no idea what those people were like. And, you know, what their private lives are like. So, I mean, I think I fall down on the side of the work, once it's created, is separate from the creator. And I think we have to weigh those creations on their own merits. You know, perhaps there are times when we would say, well, the person who created it was so despicable that I'm not going to watch it, or I'm not going to read it. But I find myself feeling more and more that there's a separation, and we've got to respect that separation.
Okay. Let me get a couple of phone calls. John and Henrietta. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I was thinking about the artists and the art. And there's a story that I have from my youth. Stan Getz had a big hit with Girl from Ipanema, and they needed a vocalist. So the guitarist's wife came in, and I'm blanking on her name, but that's whom everybody thinks of when they think of that tune. Stan Getz apparently at the time went into Verve Records and ranted and raved, why is she getting all this credit? I don't want to really pay. This was my record. And one of the band members said to an aside, good thing success hasn't changed Stan. Well, when I heard that story, I stopped listening to Stan Getz, even though I was a big jazz fan. Years later, in the earlier mid-90s, he was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, and he admitted that he'd been a major something whole for years, and that he was doing what he could to rectify that with the folks that were still alive, and admitted that, and had a complete change of heart. So I realized that some people can be redeemed. Now, I don't know if any of his problems were beyond, you know, attitude, if you will. I don't know if he was a predator or not. But at the time, a good friend said, you're not going to listen to Stan Getz anymore. You're a big jazz fan. You've got to separate the artist from the art. And I didn't listen, but in retrospect, I think there was a point there. So that's my comment.
Thank you, John. I do believe it's valuable to give space for people to change. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I know where I come down on the side of consuming art in different forms, but I never like to hear this idea that someone can be banished forever and never change, or you give up on someone changing their mind or them seeing the world differently. Absolutely, people can change. And so there was a case of John seeing it happen, seeing someone who at least moved a little bit. And
that's an interesting idea, though, that, okay, so Stan Getz, he liked. And then he hears this other information, and until Stan Getz redeems himself, the art is put in kind of an escrow. Mm-hmm. That, by the way, that is a way to do this. I think a lot of people might very much approach what they will or won't listen to or read or whatever that way. But when you think about it, that is a really, really odd sort of thing, that until the bad artist apologizes in a way that I'm satisfied with, I am putting that art away. And once that happens, I will then redeem the art itself again. And, of course, the art never changes from before apology to after apology.
I guess I take the point if you're saying I'm going to like the art versus not like it. But there's a difference, though, Bob, between saying I am not going to consume anything that might financially benefit this person until I
Which, by the way, is what we're getting with the Roseanne story now. Mm-hmm. ABC wants to do a spinoff of Roseanne without Roseanne, but they very carefully have said they don't want Roseanne to make any money from it. So that's happening in a very practical way as we speak.
Yeah, and speaking of shows that have teams of writers and other people beyond just one person, Steve in Brighton wants to bring us back to The Cosby Show. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, not so much The Cosby Show per se, but the broader case of television and film, for example. So this week, Film the Country is Incredibles 2, right? Lasseter had to step down from his studio. He had very little to do with the film. Didn't direct it, didn't write it. You boycott The Incredibles 2 when, you know, there's this aura of participation and approval. Very little done to create the art. Same thing with television. You know, with something like The Cosby Show, you have an army of writers who helped create those characters, so on and so forth. Where do you draw the line? I mean, a novelist with his novel or a painter with his painter, with his painting, right? That's a single unit there. You know, I teach film and, or I used to teach film and media, and now I teach video games. And these are, you know, massive productions. And do you let the acts of one person eliminate the entire thing? And which person do you therefore say, yeah, well, you know, the fact that he did this was bad and he was directly responsible for the entire franchise, but it gets naughty. So I'd like to hear the responses.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. So let's, Jonathan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, hey, Steve, I think that there are many people who suffer. And when we are the ones so asking for this person to sort of lose, and I feel like we're a crowd surrounding a beheading, you know, in a town square, and we want this to happen. But we don't think about the people who are going to also continue to lose out, the royalties that are maybe sustaining some artists who aren't that lucky right now. And I think that we need to be able to acknowledge that this person did something, that the people who are still benefiting from the work that they did, that their art still needs to be acknowledged. Harvey Weinstein with Salma Hayek and Frida, for example, and that story that you read about, I love that film. And to think that if I boycotted that film, she would lose again. I think that we have to be able to understand the ramifications of our chanting for this beheading in the square, because right now we can send it out in a tweet or on a Facebook post and then go back to our lives. And in actuality, it's not the person, it's the culture. We've been talking about the people who do these things, not the culture. We talk about Bill Cosby. We don't talk about the fact that NBC had a fixer with a checkbook to write checks for women. I'm presuming not just for Bill Cosby. Why was that okay? And when is NBC going to have a reckoning for their participation in that? We look at The Incredibles 2 again with that. You know, when is Disney or when is this company going to be able to then say, we're going to shift something in our culture because this is not right and this is not okay? We have to acknowledge that this is a watershed moment, but at the same time, cultures and what's okay at the larger level also has to be challenged and changed.
And I go back to Patty, and I want to hear if this moves you at all thinking about Woody Allen, or some of the lines that you kind of drew for us early for yourself, indicates there's a difference between artists who are really individual performers, like a Louis C.K., who's been caught up in Me Too, versus a Woody Allen, whose films employ lots of people, presumably many good people, who need the work. And so does that move you at all? Does that change?
Yes, it absolutely does. That was my first reaction when I heard that Roseanne had been fired, is, oh my God, what about that script girl, and what about the gaffer, and what about the electrician? But there are people, I think, there are artists who use their art in a way to promote an agenda, whether it's purposeful or not. And those are the things we pick up on. I mean, those are the things that we pick up on a Roseanne, or that I pick up on a Woody Allen. And I think the pendulum is going to have to go really far. And unfortunately, I think some people are going to suffer maybe greater than they need be, because there is a spectrum. There is, somebody was talking about, you know, politicians, not that we want to go there, but saying that, you know, what Al Franken did was perhaps, you know, at one end of the spectrum, and that what some other people have done is way at the other end of the spectrum. And does everybody deserve the same treatment?
I think the obvious answer to that, to me, should be no. I do think, especially early post-Weinstein reporting, when a lot of these stories, the dam was breaking, the Franken story comes out, I do think, you know, Jonathan kind of brought up the whole idea of kind of a little bit of the mob mentality. It happens in social media, and it can really grab onto people. I do think it's okay to say that there's a spectrum here. There are gradations of bad, and that Franken may not be Weinstein, and Morgan Freeman may not be Elvis Presley, and whatever. There's a, everything is different, and we can evaluate them on their own terms, and that doesn't make us not care, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and there's something about art that is ineffable at some point. There is something about an artist and creating art that sometimes transcends anything about the artist, mm-hmm. and that exists, I think, in and of itself. I mean, if we look at, you know, the music of Mozart, and, you know, apparently he wasn't as the kind of person that
don't
we
ruin
think.
Mozart for me.
Right?
Don't
do
no,
it. Exactly, don't do it. Exactly. You know, exactly, because that it transcends. No matter, you know, how puerile a person he may have been,
that
stands on its own. And I think there are examples like that.
Okay, Joe, you want to add to that before we get our we're way late for a break?
Well, this is a little bit far afield, but you know, you had asked before, you know, in terms of what am I struggling with? One of the things I'm struggling with, which does not have to do with literature at all. It has to do with football. And, you know, like I'm thinking, am I not going to watch any more football games, NFL games, because of what the owner's decision was in terms of not allowing the protests? And then I think, well, you know, if I don't watch, I mean, as one person, big deal. But if I don't watch it, what about those players who are going out on the line, you know, to say, I'm going to still protest or, you know, like as opposed to, you know, opposing the owners and that. So you do get into that question of you want to make a moral stance of some sort because of what somebody has done or a group of people. But on the other hand, who else is being harmed as part of it?
Sure. And you want to hit somebody in the wallet, but can you do it in such a targeted way that people who don't deserve to also be negatively impacted aren't? Mm-hmm. There's a lot to work through. We got to get a couple more phone calls in. I am way late for our only break, so let's get that now and come right back to your calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. What is a sociopath? Sabrina Brown is a professor at the University of Kentucky, and her new book is titled, I Married a Sociopath. She describes years of abuse, emotionally, physically, and financially. We'll talk to her about her harrowing story. Second hour, we're previewing the Xerox Rochester International Jazz Festival. Join us Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joe Flaherty, founder of Writer and Books, is here. Writers and Books is here. Patty Lewis is a local actor, director, and teaching artist. Jonathan Nifketha is Senior Assistant Director of Student Success and Outreach in the Multicultural Center for Academic Success at RIT. And Bob Thompson on the line with us, the director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Let's get back to your phone calls. Steve in Rochester. Different Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Evan. I share your concerns, and I first of all commend you on an excellent program and a great panel.
Thanks.
But as I'm listening to you, and I share your dilemma about trying to get your brain around enjoying art produced by somebody who has not high moral standing in the Me Too movement or for whatever reason. But, Evan, I think it's impossible to do that because I'm trying to think through a scenario in my mind here is a thought experiment, okay? So let's say you walk in, you would want to be able to walk into an art museum, Metropolitan Museum of Art, whatever, and then have every painting or whatever paintings you could be qualified by a placard next to it where the moral failings of that artist are outlined, right? This person mistreated his models or was misogynist or didn't tip a waitress, you know? So you can take it to really incredible extremes that I think you just can't do. So I think I am agreeing with you. I think we're going to have to live with the fact that many of the artists we respect and admire were flawed men and women, and it behooves us to educate ourselves about it, but it can't detract from what they've created. That's my two cents.
Yeah, so Steve, let me just follow up with you real briefly, and then I'll turn it over to the panel, because I think I find myself largely agreeing with you that it's, for the most part, it's futile to just try to consume art, books, movies, etc., from people who we feel comfortable about their values just because there's so much we don't know. That's why I joked with Patty, don't ruin Mozart for me, don't do it. But I also don't want to, while acknowledging that, I don't want to then sort of create a pass for a system that has been really rough on women, really rough on people who are not in positions of power for so long. And so I want to be able to split that difference, I think, while acknowledging that, while trying to create change so Patty students can feel the comfort or at least the confidence that they're feeling, which is great. They're seeing change. They're not expecting that they're going to have to endure what maybe women from previous generations have endured. That is a positive change. So I guess what I want to do is split that difference and make sure we hold accountable while knowing that, you know, we're not going to like put up a plaque for everything or just immediately banish anybody who takes one step down the Me Too road, if that makes sense. Is that making sense to you?
Yeah, I think you're right. And how you split that difference is really critical. And that's where knowledge is key, and then, you know, these accusations being taken seriously as your panelists have, and you are articulating. I mean, I think that's an essential step forward, right? But yeah.
All right. So I'll ask you then: Would you watch a Louis C.K. special if it was on tonight?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So I would also draw a distinction between an artist and an entertainer. You know, and I'm not sure I would view Louis C.K. as an artist as much as an entertainer, and I think I would have more latitude to not tune into an entertainer who I think is not a respect-worthy person.
Okay.
I don't know if you've thought about that. You know, you and your panel can think about that, too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, great stuff, Steve. Thank you very much. And I'll just say about Louis C.K., I will disagree with Steve on that. I think comedians are often truth tellers, and I think Louis C.K. has some bits that are just vulgar, and he's got some bits that are pretty profound, and we've sort of losing all of that stuff if we throw him out, but maybe we should throw him out. So anyway, let's go around the table. Jonathan, some thoughts on what you heard from Steve there.
Where I think I stand still is that the artist creates, and once we react to it and within this, you know, their muse interacts with something that we want, we're missing, we've never experienced, we can't lose that memory. Just that memory is going to be looked at in a different way and in a different light. And we are individually trying to reconcile with what that dissonance is now in our lives. And we want someone else to be able to say, well, if they're gone, then they're gone and that's it. We want someone else to say that this is the timetable for it to become okay. And I think we just have to get more closely connected to who we are as individuals, as artists, as consumers, to be able to acknowledge that was a beautiful moment. I really appreciate that song that I had when I was a little kid, and I remember that was my first kiss was to the song. But now I have to think about, you know, what I'm demanding out of my artists moving forward. And I think that's kind of where we need to be as individuals and as a collective.
Patty, have you moved off your line with Woody Allen or anything else?
That's going to take a little more time. But, you know, I think that the best thing about this is that we're learning how to create the right environment to make art. Because so much great art, I think, is probably never been made, because how can you work in an environment where your ideas are
continuously
put down and disregarded, or where you are afraid that, you know, if you don't respond to this or that person's advances, then, you know, you're going to be fired. And I think what this is doing is saying, this is how we make the environment to create really good art or entertainment. I would put those things together. Some entertainment is art and some art is entertainment. So I think I hope that's going to be the lasting impact of this.
Such a smart way to look at it. That's why we always invite people much smarter than the host, because we've been so focusing so much on looking back at art that's already been created. And Patty's reminding us we're at least creating a better space to create new art and more opportunity. And let's hope that continues. Final thoughts from you, Joe.
Well, I think, you know, going right to the Roseanne Barr thing in terms of what you forgive or what you might not forgive. In the case of somebody who has a show who's, you know, the gist of it is that, you know, like people who are Trump supporters are, you know, for one reason or another, and it's not because we're racists or anything like that, and then you make a racist statement like that. That to me is unforgivable to watch that show. You have somebody like Samantha Bee, and people say, I'm not going to watch Samantha Bee because of the language she used. But she was criticizing someone's behavior. And that's a difference. You know, you can criticize someone's behavior, but when you criticize and make fun of someone's race, that's a whole other thing. And so when we get to distinguishing between what someone says on TV or, you know, in an interview and what the other one does, what's the intent of what they're saying and how do we accept that as that person being an entertainer or an artist?
Okay, Bob Thompson, about 50 seconds, final thoughts. Go ahead.
Well, I think Patty hit the nail on the head. In the end, this is not a problem having to do with art. This is a problem of a culture that for centuries has privileged certain people to let them get away with all kinds of bad things, and some of those people happen to be artists. I think the real thing one needs to address is to change those kinds of systematic cultural sorts of things. I have less problem with the fact that we still listen to Wagner, even though Wagner had some really, really problematic ideas. The bigger problem is you see no female versions of Wagner coming out during that period for some very obvious reasons. That was, I think the issue here is something about something much bigger than art.
Yeah, Tchaikovsky too. I mean, unfortunately, the list in all of our favorite genres is probably longer than we would like it to be. And you know, we didn't even ask, what about voting for politicians who've had their Me Too moment and say they've changed? That's a whole separate day and a whole separate panel. Bob Thompson, always nice to have you. Thanks for sharing the hour with us, Bob.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
Jonathan, great to have you back. And thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Patty Lewis, great stuff as always. Thank you so much for
thank
being
you
here. And Joe Flaherty, nice to see you.
Great to be back, Evan.
Still reading, of course.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about books.
There's always something to talk about here between noon and 2 on member-supported public radio. Our thanks to the engineer, Rob Braden, and the producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Enjoy the afternoon. We're back with you Tuesday right here.